Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
How true love made in my life.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to take a look at double talk, double speak, Orwellian all the way. How are we being programmed? I'll discuss that and give you specific examples of doublespeak, the Orwellian concept of government and big business brainwashing. It's going on all the time, every day. Also today, the newest information on how bad is it with the climate. Stop the average person on the street. No matter what their age or educational background, more often than not, they'll tell you, well, it's getting warmer, right? And they'll mention something about global warming, but they won't know all the details. We do. And I believe that it's not possible, based upon the human condition's de-evolution at all levels, for us to do anything except a very painful karmic lesson. Here's the bad part. Those of you who do care about your environment, who make conscientious choices not to pollute it, not to contribute to the disasters of global warming, the acidification of our coral reefs, the overheating of the ocean, and all the other myriad things that are happening, you will be punished as much as the person that is clueless, selfish, self-absorbed, and doesn't care. So we're going to have a little reality check today by one of the most respected climate scientists in the world. From the University of Chicago, Professor James Anderson, Professor of Atmospheric Chemistry at Harvard University. What he says will concern you. And then I'll give a positive solution, what we can do, at least those of us who care. Also today, from our audio file, should you go to college? Is it worth it? I've talked about this before, but now that we have even more students not working, living at home, not contributing to society or even their parents, keeping them in food and shelter, what to do? Well, I'm going to deal with this in two ways. First, I'm going to give you an overview because I don't believe most people should be going to college today. It's waste. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't be getting an education. At least get an education where it doesn't cost you a lot, like in some of the trades, and where you can actually go out and find work. But then I'm going to have on Professor Gwen Dyer. Professor Dyer is a journalist, a renowned historian on international affairs, and we're going to talk about the future of work and employment, getting by the growing pains of a new world of jobs. So where are all the jobs going? We'll explain that, so at least you can understand. Also, do you remember about a year ago, and then again about 6 months ago, and then again about 2 months ago, I warned you that artificial intelligence is not the future, it's now. You just have no idea of how insidious it is. And as you see all these commercials about, someone will say, it's so much easier now. I don't have to do anything. I can ask Alexa, my Amazon, what I want, and immediately it tells me, Alexa, start the car. Alexa, start the stove. Alexa, how much time will it take to get to the opera? No matter what you ask, Alexa answers. Well, I said, remember, it is recording everything that you say, everything. And it's recording it and putting it into repositories, including National Security Agency. Well, it finally happened. We'll play you the news segment about how a woman found that the intimate conversations between her and her husband up in Portland, Oregon, was recorded by Alexa, and then Alexa sent it out to other people. Could you imagine the surprise? Conversations that were intended to stay in the context of privacy in your own home is now out there for the world. And then when Alexa was asked, Alexa, do you share this information that you're collecting with the National Security Agency or any other agency? Wouldn't answer. Why not? So then we're going to have Bill Binney on today. And he will state, as you will hear him, that he believes President Obama knew about the Trump spying and authorized it. So you see, we're hitting on all the cylinders today. We have a lot to share. And we're concerned that people have to know what's going on. Let's begin. This is from Deakin University in Australia. And it ties in with something that we have found in two separate clinical lifestyle and behavior modification studies. A healthy diet helps treat people with depression, and it saves money. In this case, it was a healthy Mediterranean diet that not only helps treat depression, but also can save consumers and patients money as a more cost-effective treatment. That's according to this latest Australian research. Quote, our new analysis looked at comparative cost in things like counseling, healthcare visits, or general practitioner visits, medicine, food, travel, and lost productivity to evaluate whether a dietary intervention like this provides value for money. And this was Mary Lou Chatterton, the senior research fellow from Deakin University. Quote, the lower cost was partially due to fewer health professional visits, such as the doctors, dentists, and psychologists. The participants on the dietary intervention also reported less time lost from unpaid activities, and including household work and child care. So this is very important because this is a groundbreaking study that provides really good evidence that diet could be used to treat depression. Now, a Mediterranean diet specifically, and that means more vegetables and fruits, more whole grains and legumes, fish, olive oil, olives, nuts. That's what is important. So they got away from the red meat and the cereals and the fried foods and fast foods and processed meats and sugary drinks. Now, it was 2 years ago, this next month, that we did a three-month study with 500 participants, and they all had to be unhealthy under medical care to get into this study and have depression or anxiety disorders, clinically diagnosed, and most of them were under medication as well. At the end of 3 months, their physicians, not us, took them off their medications or reduced them by an enormous amount, but also their diabetes was corrected, high blood pressure corrected, they lost weight, they felt good, their emotions were up. They weren't anxious or depressed, all this without medicine at all. And the results were published in a peer-reviewed journal. In fact, I've been invited to give the presentation to a group of scientists, several thousand scientists, coming up as a way of looking at our mental health. So my own clinical study is right in alignment with what they found in this Australian study. From the National Cancer Institute, a study showing that your gut bacteria, the microbiome, can control anti-tumor immune function in the liver. That's correct. Scientists have found a connection between the good bacteria in the gut and anti-tumor immune responses in the liver. And their study was published in the current issue of Science, and it was led by researchers at the Center for Cancer Research and the National Cancer Institute. Quite simply, it showed that the good bacteria found in the gut affects the liver's anti-tumor immune function, which means, in lay language, that if you have healthy bacteria and a good healthy biome, that you have a greater capacity to fight cancer. You have more natural, what are called NKT, natural killer cells, activity, and other immune modulation that can help you defeat cancer. See, every day, all of us, every human being on the planet, has cancer cells in our blood. But under normal circumstances, if you're healthy, have a good, strong immune system, your body will target those, engulf them, and through a process known as phagocytosis, dissolve them. That's why it's so important to make healthy choices. From Yale University, what makes us well? Diversity, healthcare, and public transit matter. That's according to this latest study up in New Haven. So diverse neighbors, health centers, commuter trains, these community attributes and other key factors are linked to well-being and quality of life. And this was a review of 300,000 adults, and the Yale team found that the people who live in communities that offer racial diversity and access to preventative health care, that could be a health food store, that could be a farmer's market, that could be outdoor common areas that people together play and enjoy life, no matter what their background, and good public transportations, these are among the elements that make sure that you live a longer life. This was published in PLOS One. And also, I mentioned yesterday why blueberries were so important. Well, it turns out another study today from the University of Cincinnati also asked the question why blueberries are an effective weapon in the war against Alzheimer's disease. So the larger issue is it realistic to assume that this small, little, plump blueberry really holds colossal promise in the fight against Alzheimer's? This newest research adds to the growing evidence that blueberries bursting with antioxidants and phytonutrients could help diminish the devastating effects of dementia. And as I mentioned, if there was one fruit that would be super to all others, it would be blueberries. And there's a lot of good science behind this. And one of the most important healing factors in blueberry are the flavonoids found in blueberries. And that's what they're looking at in this particular study. By the way, a minimum of 5 million Americans suffer from Alzheimer's disease, but I believe it's closer to 7 million. And with so many baby boomers now entering senior years, it's going to double or triple. And we have no capacity in the United States to handle this number. Nor are their children going to be prepared to handle the enormous demands and sacrifices. Currently, I have 3 friends whose parents have dementia or Alzheimer's, and it devastates their life because they have to be, you know, when you have Alzheimer's, that's 24/7. So something as simple as blueberries every day can help with cognitive impairment, which is a risk factor for Alzheimer's. And whether it's fresh, concentrated, freeze-dried powder, it doesn't matter. Blueberry is the ticket and can make a big difference. So something simple. And showing you the long-term effects of something that was negative, should never have been in the environment, and was taken out. And I was one of the people in the health movement and probably one of the top 2 people in the debates. We would go out and debate the scientists who supported the chemical that was being used at that time, and DES, diethylstilbestrol. In any case, a new study has shown that a failed miscarriage drug raised neurological risks 2 generations later. That means that the grandchildren of women who used a drug called diethylstilbestrol, or DES, during pregnancy have a higher risk of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. And the study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics. And it shows how significant exposure to an endocrine disruptor during pregnancy can affect brain development in later generations. Now, you know, listening to this program, that endocrine disruptors, that's our hormones, are chemicals that interfere with the body's intricate hormone system and have been associated with a number of neurological disorders. And so they really play havoc with your reproductive cells. Now we're seeing how long they last in the genetic line. 50 years. So that's why you really have to get everything out of your system and detoxify, detoxify, detoxify. Because it otherwise makes a difference. For those of you who've been on a plant-based, low-fat diet, according to the City of Hope Hospital, you're doing the right thing. You are getting a better chance of surviving breast cancer if you're on a low-fat program diet. That's how simple it is. Low-fat, and the fats that you do get, coconut, avocado, almonds, nuts, those are the good fats. So those are going to be terrific for you. And finally, from the University of Chicago, your risk of dying hinges on not diseases, but rather your well-being. And I've mentioned this so many times. In fact, for those of you who were recently at our health retreat, if you remember that one lecture I did out in that beautiful rose garden that morning, it was all about a formula for living a long life. And I said that the answer that I found was in my travels around the world, where I found people who did not have our vitamins or didn't do our aerobics or weren't doing, you know, the Pilates or weren't counting calories. They had happiness as the core of their being, and they knew the central meaning of their life. Many younger people today don't. And as a result, we do not have well-being. So that causes us to die quicker, and therefore we focus upon the diseases from which we died rather than the well-being that allows us to live a longer life. So this new study has yielded a radically different picture of aging in America, finding that how old you are plays little or no role in determining differences in health and well-being. The research say the results suggest the medical community is focusing on the wrong set of factors to determine the risk of dying, rather than relying on a checklist of affirmities like heart disease and cancer and diabetes and high blood pressure and cholesterol. Perhaps it's time to consider a new comprehensive model that looks at factors such as psychological well-being, sensory function, mobility. That's what they're saying. They're right. Good for them. And it's time that we began to look at these factors. Oh, and by the way, from the University of Gothenburg, which is in Sweden, I've been mentioning almost daily about the benefits of exercise and the importance of engaging in regular physical activity. But for those who are looking for more proof, a new Swedish study of women in fitness has discovered that a high level of cardiovascular fitness can reduce the risk of dementia by a stunning 90%, 90%. Wow. Because if you can do that with delaying dementia or avoiding it altogether because you have a higher cardiovascular fitness level, then you're going to have your memory, cognition, you have all your mental faculties together, and that's important. I'm Gary Null. We are 18 minutes into our program. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a hand, freedom for as long as you can. My mama told me, you better shop around.
A top climate scientist is warning that climate change will wipe out all of humanity unless we stop using fossil fuels over the next 5 years. That is serious. 5 years. Anderson is calling for a Marshall Plan. That's what we did after World War II, where we invested money in rebuilding Italy and Germany and other countries and Japan. And it worked. We got their economies going and improved the quality of people's lives. Everyone benefited. So that's what Anderson's calling for, a Marshall Plan style endeavor in which all of the world takes extreme measures to transition all fossil fuels completely within the next 5 years. So if we don't, then we're looking at the reality of overheating by 2022, where there's no ice left in the Arctic. And that's going to cause a massive amount of methane being released. The boreal forest of the northern latitudes, including Russia's Siberian area, Russia's boreal forest, the largest in the world, and they're then going clear across Canada and Iceland, Norway, that whole area of the world. So two things happen when all that ground that's been frozen solid for thousands of years, when that begins to thaw, methane that's released underneath from biodegraded mass material, it becomes released into the atmosphere. Now, you're not talking then about CO2, carbon dioxide. You're talking about methane, which is multiple times more potent causing global warming. So we're going to have a massive effort, because once this feedback loop starts, you can't stop it. And then it'll affect the conveyor belt in the Atlantic. And then that'll slow down or stop. And then that affects the entire temperature over much of Europe, certainly Western Europe, and everything on the Mediterranean. That'll cause a massive shift. Then the insects come, because right now insects can't live easily at high altitudes, but when it warms up, they can. And it used to be in Arizona, when you're in lower Arizona, which is southern Arizona, like Phoenix and Tucson, you go in the summertime, you go up to the higher altitudes around Flagstaff, about 2.5 hour drive up, 3 hours, and you're up at a very high altitude. And in between Flagstaff, where the university is, and Phoenix, you have Sedona, and kind of a nice artsy community, a small community. Very pretty for about the 5 minutes you can drive through it. Well, all the looks like painted red rock formations. And now, when I was up in Flagstaff, massive forest fires and massive die-off of trees due to insects, insects that historically not been devastating. Then as you're coming up the eastern part of the United States near the coast, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, and northern Florida, you're seeing, and also over to Alabama, you're seeing forest, A, being cut down for lumber, and it's huge, the amount of lumber being taken out. Well, that changes not just the topography, it changes the ecosystems, but also it's drying out. And as it dries out from the heat, insects start devastating trees that historically had not been devastating. How many trees last year in California? Over 100 million trees died. So then that makes it more susceptible to losing its watershed potential, holding all the water in the tree and its system, the root system, but also preventing erosion. And now it's fodder for fire. So you have to understand feedback loops. So here's my... And this is not the first person to suggest this. We've had people on this program, Kevin Hester, Guy McPherson, and others who've said the same thing. So right now we're looking at, if we don't change within 5 years, shortly thereafter, we'll be into so many feedback loops that you're going to have a lot of places that are not going to be easy to live in. You're going to have places you won't be able to grow crops, especially grain crops. By the way, the United States is no longer the world's number one grower and exporter of grains. Russia now has that distinction. And one of the reasons is that the soil is getting too hot. And when the soil goes up only 3 degrees, you change the dynamic of the seed in relationship to the soil. As an organic farmer, someone who's taught organic farming, had the first organic farm teaching in New York State at the old Fertiller Farm, I would show people that you have two tracts of land, identical soil. You change the temperature just by 3 degrees, and suddenly one that is germinating and growing, the other is having difficulty germinating. You only get partial germination. That's how sensitive the soil is. So you don't have to have a huge spike in heat, or then you get so much water that there's no place for it to go. In fact, in some counties in Florida, they're now banning all fertilizer. Why? Because if it's nitrogen-based, it can go into the water system. If it goes in the water system, good luck getting it out, and then try to drink that polluted water. Very dangerous. Why? Because there's been so much rain that there's no place left for the water to go. It's clear up to the surface. That means there's going to be a lot of flooding. That means a lot of plants are going to rot. That means a lot of fruit trees' systems, their root systems will rot. So these are all negative feedback loops. I'm looking at it from two perspectives. One perspective is that I do not believe that we will do anything whatsoever to address our crisis. I don't believe that we care enough. Most people don't care. Some absolutely do care, but the majority don't. And the ones that count, major industries and the government, don't. And so I suggest you do the following. I suggest you start looking now, while there's time. You don't have to run out tomorrow, where there's time, and look for progressive communities that are sustainable communities. There are a lot of them out there. And there's going to be a whole lot more happening as well, where you're in a place that is not near nuclear power, you're not in a flood zone, you're not in Hurricane Alley, you're not in a tornado area or an earthquake fault, or where there's gas hydrofracking, where you've got good water and soil and drainage, and then become aware of the inexpensive installation of solar today. Well, the new technology is terrific. They have invented new blinds for your house that are solar blinds. You close the blind, and the sun hits your blind on the outside and immediately creates electricity for the house. Then you open the blind, and it provides electricity. So at nighttime, you don't need the blind open, and you can close it. But you're producing electricity. Paint on the house also is a new form of the nanotechnology of converting that into energy. So it's getting less and less expensive to use solar. Hydroponics is the way to feed the future. And being around people that you have something in common with, that you can enjoy being in a community, and just start now, because we've got about 5 years. And then it's all going to collapse. And those who have the money will move into green zones, and those who can't afford to be in the green zone, well, look at some of these dystopian sci-fi films. That's a pretty accurate look. You're not going to have public services. You're going to have to be struggling to survive. So the sci-fi writers actually had it right. And I got this. Sometimes I get interesting emails, so I'm going to read this one to you. I'm going to quote it verbatim. It says, four simple questions from an attorney. Quote, here are four simple questions from an attorney. Are there any logical answers? Question mark. You be the judge. Here's what I would like to know. If the truth ever comes out and it's decided that Obama never was eligible to be president, what happens to all the laws he signed into being and all of the executive orders? Should they all be null and void? Here are four simple questions from a reputable attorney. this should really get your gray zone churning, even if you're an Obama fan. For all of you, and then it goes in one. Back in 1961, people of color were called Negroes. So how can the Obama birth certificate state he's African-American when the term wasn't even in use at that time? Number two, the birth certificate that the White House released lists Obama's birth as August 4th, and it lists Barack Hussein Obama as his father. No big deal, right? At the time of the Obama, part of this cut off, I can't read all of it, also shows that his father is age 25 years old and that Obama's father was born in Kenya, Africa. This couldn't seem like anything of concern except the fact that Kenya did not even exist in 1963. 2 whole years after Obama's birth and 27 years after his father's birth, Obama's father had been born in a country that did not exist yet. Up until Kenya was formed in 1963, it was known as the British East African Protectorate. Number three, on the birth certificate released by the White House, he lists the place of birth as, and again, it's, I can't read the first word because it's cut off, maternity and gynecological hospital. This cannot be because the hospitals in question in 1961 were called the Kawai Kaolni Hospital and Maternity Home, respectively. The name did not change to the current one until 19-something, again, it's cut off. These two hospitals merged. How can this particular name of a hospital be on the birth certificate in 1961 if the name had not yet been applied until 1978? And finally, perhaps a clue comes from Obama's book on his father. He states that he was proud of his father fighting in World War II. I'm not a math genius, so I would need some help from you. Barack birth certificate says his father was 25 years old in 1961 when Obama was born. That would put his father's date of birth approximately 1936. If my math holds, then he would be 3 years old at that time. And this is from Richard, alleged to be from Richard Silverlieb, attorney at law. Okay, I guess that's it then. I guess that the birthers were correct and that all the rest of us, wait, just one little thought I had. Let me just go through those 4 points again from a little different perspective, one called facts. For the first point of this attorney's, actually he's a real estate lawyer in New Jersey with Trump ties and who is a Trump supporter, it's patently false. The first reference made to African Americans was in a newspaper article written in 1780s. There was also a Philadelphia advertisement in 1782 noting a famous black preacher as African American. Although Negro was the most commonly used word, but African American goes back much further, and abolitionists would sometimes use it because Negro was regarded as demeaning by blacks. Also, the Hawaiian hospital where Obama was born was founded by the Hawaiian king, a queen. Therefore, given the racial sensitivities at the time, it is perfectly reasonable that they would list African American instead of Negro on the birth certificates. Hawaii had been a more progressive and racially accepting state compared to the others. Also, to the use of the word Kenya. The word Kenya for the region was first used by Russian explorers and colonists in the late 1850s. In fact, Kenyans used Kenya as the name of their country. Yes, it was called British East African Protectorate or British East Africa, but it was officially renamed to Kenya in 1920. The attorney is misinforming people. It was in 1963 elected its first prime minister and became an internationally recognized nation. And to the issue, the Hawaiian hospital. I don't know where this guy is getting this from. His source he cites has no mention of the name he cites in his creed. In fact, the actual name change was to the Kapiloni Medical Center for Women and Children. However, what started as a maternity home became the gynecological hospital in 1958, before Obama's birth. This is based upon a brochure by the Hawaiian Catholic Social Services, which referred unwed mothers to the small maternity and gynecological hospital, which was located in the maternity home. And finally, as to his father serving in World War II, this is a twist, because his biological father was absent from his life and upbringing. The man who really functioned as his father, whom he lived with from age 10 onward, was his maternal grandfather, Stanley Dunham. He was a World War II vet, enlisting after Pearl Harbor and serving in the European arena, and got medical services after discharge. So, and later Obama clarified this point. So unfortunately, to the birthers, no smoking guns, to any of those points, just additional misinformation, and that's unfortunate. And finally, I believe that we are living at a time where we have accepted without question whatever the government or its agents or agencies or major corporate public relations doublespeak says, do we believe? The high master doublespeak is certainly Donald Trump. Well, actually, he has a very difficult time with single speak, but has a natural talent for contradicting himself repeatedly to get what he wants. He has a long history of turning his failures, football team, university, bankrupting casinos, Trump stakes, Trump airlines, into success stories. But then Americans raised on the stuff of doublespeak, the Orwellian concept of government brainwashing. Why is this important? Because there's a little statement in, go back and read 1984. I hope you do. Because in one area, the people who control everyone wants to make them feel good. So they say that they are reducing the percentage of chocolate from 30 to 20%. But then this is told as a positive. So immediately everyone is celebrating. People leave the factories. They go out from their businesses. They are holding, you know, placards praising the government because they're increasing their rations. No, they're decreasing their rations. They're making you believe through doublespeak. The National Council of Teachers offers an annual doublespeak award. Reagan received it for saying the massive land-based missile system were peacemakers. No, there is no such thing as a missile being a peacemaker. Bush, taking advantage of the freshly 9/11 terrorized American public and into an Iraq invasion. And Trump is up for the next one. Well, bring peace and democracy to the world, right? Peace, freedom, and democracy in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Vietnam, in Libya, in Syria. No, we brought weapons of mass destruction, not peace. We've heard we have the lowest unemployment rate, and yet we have 96 million Americans who could work, did work, and are not listed. Hence, our real unemployment rate is 24 to 28%. We say we have job growth. Is it really jobs or more robots doing human work? We're pumping out a lot of cars out of Detroit, yet there are very few cars from workers in the parking spaces. That's because of robotics. America is prospering, we're told. What if you're the 250 million who are not? Washington is the shining light on the hill for the world. But the rest of the world sees us through eyes of contempt. Trump is urging African Americans to vote for him because he has nothing to lose in doublespeak. The GOP tax plan means that everybody will benefit, but only the rich benefited. Crime is on the rise, so we need more strict laws and more law and order, more police and militarization of the police. Actually, crime is declining. And accusing immigrants of crime, therefore, it lets them be exported back, even those who've never committed a crime and wouldn't commit a crime. Compared to other advanced nations, we do not adequately support vital infrastructure projects. yet we call ourselves exceptional. We do not take adequate care of retirees despite Social Security compared to other nations. Compared to other advanced nations, we do not take adequate care of pregnant women, newborns, or children. There are 18 million children right now as I speak who are going to go to bed hungry today. And we say we are a nation that is prosperous. Despite massive student loan programs, we do not provide affordable higher education to our young people who frequently graduate with enormous debt, and we make no effort to cancel their debt, yet we canceled the debt of Wall Street banks that did nothing to benefit us. We do not provide adequate job security or unemployment benefits to workers compared to every other advanced nation, yet we say we care about our workers. Compared to other advanced nations, we do not adequately deal with our enormous drug and drug abuse problems, and instead we lock people up and further damage their lives. Among all advanced nations except one, the U.S. does not adequately provide high-speed railroad access to its citizens. We use the word downsize, which means layoffs, servicing the target, which means bombing them. We are a nation awash in doublespeak. I just want to bring it to your attention. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. We're going to go over to my guest, Dr. Gwen Dyer, D-Y-E-R. And Gwen is a UK-based Canadian journalist and columnist, world-renowned historian in international, on international affairs. And he holds a doctorate in military and Middle Eastern history from King's College in London and was a past person engaged in American, British, and Canadian navies. And in the past, he has taught war studies at the Royal Military Academy in the United Kingdom, and he is the author of War, which was the basis for a television series that aired on the BBC and PBS, and his most recent book is Growing Pains, The Future of Democracy and Work, which outlines some of the greatest social and political threats to our globalized world that we're facing in the future. His website is GWYNNEDYER.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here, Gary.
A significant dilemma I find in our Western societies today is the lack of creativity to envision a different future that challenges the status quo model of progress and further development. And one failure of this lack of visioning has been a regression backwards into nationalist sectarianism that is giving rise to extreme right movements, evidenced in the United States by Trump. And in the meantime, people are not looking at their economic conditions and likely futures carefully enough, such as supporting an increased minimum wage or a universal wage. And also globalization is spurring further automation of jobs, which will increase unemployment and reduce wages that are already low. So would you please speak about this relationship between globalization, that both Democrats and Republicans are supportive of, doesn't matter which administration, Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., Obama and Clinton and Trump, they all support this. And also the push towards more automation of jobs, and provide some of the statistics of job loss due to automation. And then second, we have been led to believe for many years now that the trade agreements during the Clinton years destroyed manufacturing in America and moved jobs overseas. And this certainly is part of the true story. However, the facts, particularly with renewed growth in manufacturing in the United States, offers another or parallel scenario. So, yes, we have manufacturing, but it's without a lot of human beings. So take your time and show the short and long-term consequences of rising automation. The forum is yours.
Okay, well, thank you. It's kind of a tall order, but we'll do it. First of all, you're absolutely right. Between the turn of the century, 2001, and now, and mostly in the first 10 years, the United States lost one-third of its manufacturing jobs. We went from 19 million to 12 million. And those jobs were destroyed almost entirely by automation. About 15% of them died of other causes, like being sent abroad. But that was mainly a phenomenon of the 1990s. In the 21st century, it's always automation that's the job killer. But, of course, manufacturing production rose. The River Rouge plant in Detroit, the Ford plant, is still churning out cars, just as the employee parking lot's nine-tenths empty. And the reason that the jobs are being replaced by automation, first and foremost, in what we call the Rust Belt, is because the Rust Belt specialized in manufacturing, assembly lines. And those are the easiest things in the world to automate. I mean, even dumb 1990s computers could program a robot arm to replace a worker on the assembly line. So the people were laid off. I mean, they're still there. The factories are still there, but they're no longer in the factories. They're not needed. And you know, from an employer's point of view, automation is wonderful. Not only do the machines not have to be paid, which is kind of a plus, but also they don't push back. They don't talk back. They don't expect lunch breaks. They don't expect washroom breaks. You know, 2 weeks annual paid holiday, sick leave. You know, and if they do get caught in an industrial accident, they don't sue the management. So, you know, what's not to love about automation from a manufacturer's, a manager's point of view? And it's moving out of simple assembly line jobs. The computers are smarter now. First self-driving cars are on the road. That means basically 4.5 million driving jobs in the United States are for the high jump in about 10 to 15 years. I mean, there's a few bugs yet to work out of the automation, but once they're selling those things on the free market, the first people in the queue to buy them are going to be taxi company owners, long-distance haulers. The 18-wheelers are also on the road as self-drivers, and bus companies and so on. There go all those driving jobs. And even some of the white-collar jobs, back-office services and medical practices, legal practices, things like that, are being automated. Anything repetitive can be automated. And if there's enough people doing that job, it's worth the money to invest in the automation. So that's the bottom line. And even 5 years ago, it was clear, there was a famous study done predicting that within 20 years, 47% of existing American jobs would be destroyed by automation. That's half. So, you know, Mr. Trump actually did us a favor because he gave us a wake-up call. He got elected by people who were either out of work or fearing being out of work and basically working at minimum wage jobs already. The manufacturing jobs are gone in the Rust Belt. If he didn't get those three Rust Belt states, he wouldn't be the president. And he appealed directly to their anger, their sense of abandonment, but he gave a wrong diagnosis. He blamed it all on foreign trade, you know, free trade. Now, you asked about free trade and all of that, and the answer is the trading model changed in the world in the early 1990s. Before that, we had a thing called the General Agreement on Taxes, Tariffs, or something else, taxes, whatever, trade and taxes, trade and tariffs, GATT, GATT. That was replaced in the early 90s by what we've got now, the World Trade Organization. And the World Trade Organization elevates completely free trade, regardless of the damage done to jobs, into an obsession. Before that, we negotiated sector by sector. A lot of free trade is good, but, you know, protect people's jobs if you can, and find other jobs for them before you do it. And so that model has helped the destruction. And jobs did go to Mexico, jobs did go to China, sent by American owners, of course, who wanted to pay people $3 an hour instead of $25 an hour. But that's basically over. And in fact, some of the people, factory owners who sent jobs abroad in the 90s from the United States, laid off American workers, are now bringing the factories back because they don't have to put that many workers in the factories anymore. You know, you were paying 1,000 Americans, and it was very expensive, and they sent them to China, it was cheap. You bring it back, you hire 100 Americans to supervise the automation, and you can afford that, and it's attractive because you now you're speaking English, and you've got a reasonably predictable legal system you're working in. It's better from that point of view. The jobs are not coming back. Trump can't bring them back. So what you're looking at is large and very rapidly expanding unemployment. You quoted a figure, so 24%. The best figure I have for unemployment among American men of prime working age is one produced by a guy called Nicholas Ebersfeldt, who works, by the way, for the American Enterprise Institute, not exactly a left-wing organization. And he said in a book 2 years ago, 17% of American men of prime working age are not working. Most of them are not, you know, sort of on the unemployment rolls. They're not counted. They've given up looking for work because there's none to be had in their area. But they are unemployed. And frankly, if it was the 1930s, they'd be out in the streets rioting now. You know, there'd be blood in the streets like there was in the 30s. Unemployment in the Great Depression of the 1930s hit 24% in the United States. It's at 17% now, but amazingly, no riots in the streets, basically, because, you know, there is a welfare state in the United States. It's kind of rudimentary by comparison with other people's welfare states, but, you know, it does mean when you lose your job, you're not immediately, you know, out of your apartment on the street with your children and your belongings around you because you've been evicted and your car's repoed because you have no money at all. There's some money coming in, and that was deliberately done, the building of the welfare states all over the West after the Second World War, to avoid sliding back into the kind of mass unemployment. Well, you can't stop the mass unemployment, but you can stop the political consequences, or so it seemed. And we haven't had riots in the streets. These people do, however, still vote. And boy, are they angry. They've been abandoned. So,
well,
you know.
Let me add one caveat. One of the reasons there is a discrepancy between your 17% figure from 2 years ago and the 24% zero hedge figure I'm using is because they've done something new. Every part-time job you had, they added as a new full-time job. So if you have two jobs, that's a game. So
that's two people.
That's correct. So that's how, if you consider that, then you're up somewhere between 24 and 28%. Let's talk for a moment, if you would, please, about artificial intelligence. As long as there's a capitalist system that is based upon the ideology of infinite growth and progress, automation and artificial intelligence will continue. And it is a critical part of postmodern capitalism's DNA. What do you envision as being the more dire possible consequences of automation trend at the social and cultural level? And are there viable alternatives that we can look for solutions? Please address that.
Certainly. Look, the first thing to say is you're not going to stop the automation. AI, artificial intelligence, we may restrict for reasons other than employment because you don't want, you know, sort of Skynet taking over. But you're not going to stop the automation. Frankly, why would you want to? I mean, is it really that much fun working on an assembly line job? Point is, you got to have self-respect and you got to have money, and you'll get very cross if you don't. And that's the present situation, because if you lose your job, you're regarded as a loser. In a much broader sense. And really, we owe Mr. Trump a debt of gratitude. I hate to say it, but he did provide the wake-up call. He's like the canary in the coal mine, you know? Giant orange canary. And, you know, suddenly everybody woke up and said, oh, my God, they're angry. Oh, yes, I see why. There's this massive unemployment. I mean, the data was there years ago if you went looking for it, but everybody got the point after Mr. Trump got elected, and the similar things have been happening in a less dramatic way. You know, Brexit in Britain, fascist nearly, well, come winning a third of the votes in the French presidential election, a new government in Italy that's totally populist wall to wall. So we have a problem, Houston. You know, we have to deal with this. And the encouraging thing is, people have responded by thinking, okay, that's the future. How do we make it look better than Blade Runner's future? Where, you know, they're never explicit about the economy in Blade Runner, but you can kind of guess all the good jobs were taken by machines long ago, and everybody is down and out. No, what we need to do is find a way of making sure everybody is still comfortable and politically committed to reasonably moderate ways of doing business, even as the jobs go. And that's why everybody is now talking about basic income. And I shouldn't say everybody, but there's already five countries running basic income pilot programs. And it's only, 16 months since Mr. Trump, 18 months since Mr. Trump was elected. He really, you know, he got the horse going. And these basic income projects are basically an attempt to provide a minimum level of income for everybody that is actually not demeaning, that allows you to have a roof over your head, it doesn't leak, and, you know, got clothes in your back, food on the table, you're driving a car, late model, no, I'm afraid you can't afford that, but a car, you know, and take a vacation somewhere in the United States, you're not going abroad once a year. That kind of basic income should be, according to this argument, a birthright. And if it was a birthright for everybody who's an American, then one hopes that the anger would be damped down to a very great extent. I mean, you know, it's not bad having leisure time if you actually have money, too. And so there's experiments underway. The one in the United States is in California. It's being run by, actually, the moguls of Silicon Valley. Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, they're all involved in it. Biggest one is in Canada, in the province of Ontario. They're giving 4,000 people in this pilot program a basic income of $34,000 a year. If you're earning under that, you get made up to that amount, $48,000 if you're a married couple.
Gwen, let us have you back for a full hour to go into greater depth on this very important topic. You've opened up the subject. You've piqued our curiosity. But we need more insight from you, and you've got a lot to share. So we look forward to a return visit.
I will enjoy that. Take care.
And Gwen Dyer's latest book is Growing Pains. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.